Well, things we probably were still going, so let me just...
What?
We'll edit that later, giving you that interruption.
That's all right.
So, just moving for a moment from bikes to public transport more generally. It's probably another area where more can be done in Fremantle.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why, the council has been particularly vocal in advocating for public transport into Fremantle because if we're really going to, rejuvenate the Fremantle CBD, you need pedestrian traffic, you need foot traffic. You've got the Fremantle CBD is a pre-Second World War urban form that require with traditional shop fronts. And so you need pedestrian traffic, past those shop fronts to really rejuvenate them. And it's, this thing about the Fremantle CBD, it's a difficult one because the long-term decline of the Fremantle CBD is a function both of the post-war car dependency and people getting in their car and driving to the big shopping centres rather than getting on the tram and going into Fremantle. And also things like containerisation. I mean, you think before containerisation, just how many people worked in Fremantle, both on the waterfront, in railway, in the goods yards, all the shipping agencies, that sort of thing. I mean, you just had tens of thousands of people with jobs directly related to the port, knocking off work and going to the pubs, going to the shops, doing all that kind of thing. And so even if you needed to buy something big, you would take the tram or ride your bike into Fremantle, pick it out, and then a truck or a horse and cart would deliver it to you, a bit of furniture, something like that. So how to recreate, Fremantle, not as a sort of just a museum piece, but a real vibrant, pumping city centre, you need that pedestrian foot traffic. And that's going to come about through two ways. One, you need people living and working in Fremantle again, which doubtless you've spoken to people about already. But you also need that public transport connectivity into it, because this idea that somehow Fremantle will be able to provide acres of so-called free parking to compete with the big shopping centres is not feasible. I mean, having said that, when you're on council, you're very familiar with the complaints about how supposedly difficult it is to get parking in Fremantle, which isn't a line I accept. It is not hard to find parking in Fremantle. I don't know, when people say it's hard to find parking in Fremantle, it's hard to, what do they mean compared to Coolin or Condinan? I don't know, or compared to Glebe in Sydney or Carlton in Melbourne. I don't know when people think cars.
People also have to know where the car parks are, and the street system in Rio can be a challenge. How do you get to the Henderson Street car park?
That's right. It is. I mean, Fremantle's sort of higgledy-piggledy layout is difficult for someone who's new to the place to navigate and understand. Oh, I guess the strategy of council has been to establish, main car parks on the fringe of the CBD, with the hope that most people, particularly who are going to Fremantle for longer stays, will drive to those car parks
and find their way in
and park because, as it is from the large car parks, such as at the former Stan Riley site or next to the prison, it's. In general, it's no further to walk from those car park to your destination than it is from the car park at Garden City to wherever it is you're going in Garden
it's
City.
It's entirely accurate. It's all relative, isn't it?
It is, but I think sometimes people's perception of it being hard to find parking in Fremantle is derived from the fact that they might, often they see if they can park in front of, on a street car park right in front of the shop they're going to, as if it is Coolin or Condinan, That doesn't work. And so then they go around to the corner to one of those funny little sort of pocket car parks that exist in Fremantle where buildings were demolished in the 60s and 70s and a car park with like 12 car bays was put there in the hope they can go there. And that's full. And then their third option is to actually go to the large car park, which is half empty. It would have been a lot easier if they'd just gone there in the first instance. So then in their mind, it was difficult to find parking in Fremantle, and then they have to pay for it as well. As an aside, I would say that, you know, I always make the point that there is no such thing as free parking. There's parking that is free at the point of use, but all parking is paid for by somebody somehow, somewhere. There's, you know, nothing is free.
Well, I can see it in the future. The Shipping News will have to sponsor a public transport and parking night where we have debate on this. But I take your point. I think they're very well made. Can we come back to the question of what you addressed very early on, that is post-war reconstruction in Australia. After the Second World War, an economy that had to grow, we took a lot of our cues in so many areas from post-war reconstruction in the UK, and you got a lot of new towns, Hilton being one of them, and the Kwinanas,
yes,
and many others. And you had investment by state governments around Australia in what then became identified as working class suburbs. People eventually bought those homes, or they got them on war service loans. But there were also homes that the state built and basically rented out for people who couldn't afford to buy their own. And today we speak of social housing and affordable housing, related but distinct concepts. Is there an issue in those areas for Fremantle? Something we need to address?
Well, I think this question has to be addressed within the context of the broader housing affordability crisis that exists in Australia. I am very strongly of the view that housing is one area where Australian policy is really broken and bad, and most Australians just don't get how bad it is. Any sense that Australian housing policy is normal, I think people need to lose, because it's not. This housing affordability crisis is a real crisis. And just to put it in context, as you say, immediately after the Second World War, there was, you know, government actually took responsibility for housing.
It was Reconstruction Authority.
That's right. In the same way that government, you know, we assume that government, that the state is responsible for education or healthcare. It was responsibility of the state to address this issue. And so then for a brief period there in Australia, public housing was just a normal housing option, along with private rental or private ownership, for large layers of the working class, for the working class. But since then, both Labor and Liberal governments have just not reinvested in public housing, and they've allowed it to shrink and shrink and shrink and shrink as a percentage of our total housing stock, and they've allowed it essentially, you know, as it's shrunk and shrunk and shrunk, it's sort of become harder and harder to qualify for it. You have to become poorer and poorer and poorer to actually be a lower and lower income to qualify, such that it has now become welfare safety net housing in Australia, such that most people kind of don't identify with it. Most working people don't even identify with the idea of more investment in public housing, because it's got nothing to do with them. In fact, they probably just, for them, public housing, the image in their mind is just the today, tonight horror story of the neighbour from hell, and they don't want to have anything to do with it, right? And something just to put this in perspective,
yeah,
is that public housing is now 4% of our total housing stock in Australia. By comparison, in Denmark, it's 20%. And in France, it's 44%. And then if you overlay on top of that, we have the weakest protections, some of the weakest protections for private tenants in the OECD. And you really start to, you grasp this problem, and you start to see why in Australia home ownership is so important, because home ownership is the only way you can have housing security in Australia.
It was always very high in those post-war years through the 60s and 70s. The percentage compared to other countries of homeowners. The question is, coming back from that broad policy issue around the country to a local government setting, is there anything Fremantle can contribute, or is it simply a question of how it liaises with state planning authorities to work out the zoning of land and encouraging initiatives?
I mean, you know, unlike, say, Britain, where, you know, it's so familiar with the term from Britain of council housing, where, you know, public housing was essentially administered by local government in the United Kingdom.
Well, Mrs. Thatcher sold them all off.
Well, that's right. But But obviously, in their context, you know, there wasn't a sort of a third tier of government like we have in Australia. They had much bigger local governments. Look, this is an issue for Fremantle because, I mean, Fremantle is gentrifying, and so it's that this housing affordability thing is quite sharp. You know, I think there are people who in the past would have tried to live in, you know, move to South Fremantle who now move in Hilton, and there's now people who are priced out of Hilton who are going to Coobal up. You know, we are seeing that sort of process take place. And, you know, City of Fremantle is in principle, is committed to the idea of housing affordability and diversity of housing offering in Fremantle, but there's not a whole lot of levers that local government has around that. So, and you know, local government, certainly not Fremantle, doesn't have the sort of capital that would require to
be the front.
Yeah, to really make it happen, to make a qualitative difference. So, I mean, so there's things we can do around the edges. So, for instance, affordable housing quotas were set in the Amendment 49, so the scheme amendment for the centre of Fremantle. And just to give you an example of how local government is constrained, you know, we local government is not allowed to mandate minimum levels of, you know, affordable or low income housing in developments. We just don't have the legal power to do that. The only place where we can do it is by incentivizing it. So in the case of, to put it sort of crudely, in the case of the Amendment 49 area in the centre of Fremantle, a developer can, as of right, do four, you know, on a given site, a developer might be able to do four stories. But if they want to go to seven stories, then they have to meet the you know, X number of green stars and X percentage of affordable housing. But that then relies on the developer doing the sums and thinking, well, I can make more profit by doing a bigger development, even if I have to put in a percentage of affordable housing, than if I just did the as of right, you know. And so there's no guarantee it'll happen.
No,
you know?
But it gets the thinking, Sam. I have a feeling we could talk for a good part of the day about various issues, and I'm just going to have to move
because
of time. But what are, whether it's in the Hilton ward, issues that need to be confronted there of whatever nature, what we've talked about or other issues, and what about the rest of Fremantle? Bring us back to this well-known historic centre and places like the port, about which there's a lot of debate. Are there particular sort of landmark issues that you think Fremantle are going to have to confront or need to confront?
Well, I think this, to come back to an issue that we didn't sort of fully cover off, I think this public transport one remains a really important one. If we really want to revitalise the city centre of Fremantle, then we need to make it easy and efficient and convenient for people to take public transport or ride their bikes into the centre of Fremantle to do their shopping.
Yes.
And that's where I'm, to be frank, I'm really disappointed that Metronet doesn't yet. I'm a big fan of Metronet in general terms, but it also has to be said that there is nothing in Metronet scheduled for anything south of the river and west of the freeway.
Yes.
And in the first iteration of Metronet, and so in the state election before last, Labor did propose extending the rail line from Coburn Central, you know, essentially following the goods line into Fremantle. So that's one, you know, but that's now sort of disappeared from all that's sort of been pushed off into the Never Never. But that would be a really transformative project, and it would really allow part of what I would call Greater Fremantle's hinterland to access.
So that would bring the south and the southwest. People would be able to easily access, get off the train or a bus, and they're in the city of Fremantle.
That's exactly right. And then the other one that the city of Fremantle has been pushing even stronger is making South Street a transit corridor, so linking Murdoch to Fremantle. And I think they're particularly important because Fremantle has embraced, in the last 10 years, has embraced the idea that we do need to densify Perth. That is to say, Perth urban sprawl can't keep going on forever.
Yes.
It is already too sprawled and too spread out and too unsustainable. Yes. And that density done well is okay.
Yes.
But, you know, even in Fremantle, you know, on a site, for argument's sake, a former petrol station site, you know, even the idea of putting in, say, four-storey apartments, so we're not talking about Gold Coast towers, even that is controversial within the community. You know, there's kickback. People think, oh, it's going to density, there's going to be more traffic. Now, even if you, you know, even if the development steps down, there's no overshadowing. You know,
Part of itself gets people very excited. Any densification,
even relatively mild densification, produces kickback from the existing residents. And you know, there's understandable reasons for that, you know. Now, I'm not going to die in a ditch over every single development that's been approved in Fremantle. But in general, I think the way Fremantle has approached this has been good, has been measured. You know, one, we do actually want more people living and working in Fremantle, particularly, you know, and that's particularly important for the CBD. And secondly, I think you know, this council does recognise that Perth's urban sprawl has to stop at a certain point. I would say that Fremantle has embraced that necessity, but we need the payoff. You know, we need the public transport investment to go with it, because otherwise our residents will rightly say, well, we've shouldered some of the burden, if you want to put it that way, of increasing densification, and so we need the better public transport to make our lives more livable to go with it. And we're just not seeing that investment in public transport, but also other infrastructure, in particularly in Fremantle itself, but also the broader Fremantle area to go with it. And I think that is a real, that's a problem, and it's something that
that's a matter of negotiation
with the state. Absolutely.
And probably the Commonwealth to an extent.
That's right.
Probably to finish off our discussions today, the sort of the looming decision over the port, and I think you once worked on the waterfront, is that right?
I did for 12 years. Eight years at in Fremantle, and 4 years before that in Sydney. So I worked for the company that was called P&O Ports, that is now called DP World, which is, you know, one of half of the duopoly of stevedoring in Australia.
Running basically. The ports. So you have a really good sense of what goes there. Do you have some position about the port? I suppose, again, it's going to be one of these infrastructure decisions made at a central state level, and then Fremantle are going to be left responding and reacting to it.
Look, I support the maintenance of a working port in Fremantle.
Yes.
And I don't, you know, I cannot believe that shutting down the existing port and losing all the embedded energy within it to build a new port somewhere else could possibly stand up to a rigorous benefit cost ratio analysis that takes into account all social, environmental, and financial things. Now, bear in mind the long term planning for Fremantle for the port has always been that if and when North Fremantle reaches capacity, that at that point we'd build another container port in Cockburn Sound. But traditional bipartisan planning always worked on the assumption that that would be as well as the inner harbour, not instead of. If you mean instead of, I mean, that means you have to move all that capacity to the outer harbour. It means that an outer harbour would have to be twice as big, a facility in the outer harbour would have to be twice as big than it otherwise would be the case. And I just can't see that makes any sense. You know, the embedded energy in the existing port is not just the light towers, it's the wharf, it's the dredging. You already have one area that is fairly substantially, you know, environmentally degraded. That's history. So you should not take lightly doing it again somewhere else, you know?
Yes.
And all the, you know, the dredging and disruption that would be necessary to make a facility in the outer harbour bigger than it need be. And so in that sense, to my way of thinking, both, you know, Row 8 and Row 8 Perth Freight Link
yes.
and build an outer harbour now and close the inner harbour are two sides of the wrong coin. And they both miss, they both, in my opinion, they both miss that. The central thing we need to be thinking about is sustainable transport to the port as well. And also getting our heads around the fact that the greatest cause of congestion in and around, and growth of congestion in and around the port, is not truck traffic to the port, it's people driving their cars. You know, for us sustainable transport advocates, they're saying you're not stuck in traffic, you are the traffic. So in actual fact, in the last few years, container or truck container movements to the port have actually plateaued. So across Perth as a whole, the total number of vehicle journeys is rising, and kilometres done, you know, is rising more rapidly than our population. You know, people are driving more places, more often, further. I would say that the inner harbour is sustainable, but we need to prioritise a few things. We need to prioritise getting freight on rail. Now, Fremantle already has, of the major ports, Fremantle at around 20% now, Fremantle already has the highest percentage of freight on rail at 20%. Before the whole Row 8 Perth Freight Link blew up, you know, that the supposed bipartisan target was 30%. So, well, let's get to 30%. Now, there's things you have to do to get to 30%, because at the moment, if you put a container on a train, the only place you can send it is out to Forest Field, Kewdale. So we need more than one intermodal hub where you can put a container on a train for it to be efficient and worthwhile to do so. That's the first thing. The second thing is to eliminate empty running of trucks. A third thing would be to incentivize truck movements outside of peak hour. So the port itself operates 24 hours, 7 days a week.
Yes.
You know, there's significant capital infrastructure there for the stevedoring companies. They're not going to have a ship sitting there doing nothing. So we should incentivize truck movement outside of peak hour when High Street is empty. And then fourthly,
yes,
to pick up the point I made before, is the biggest cause of congestion in and around the port is just us in our motor cars, and yes, that's why public transport around in and out of Fremantle remains as much as the answer to the question of congestion around the port as anything else.
Well, until COVID hit, we were the shipping news about to have the great port debate. It was all set up down at the Maritime Museum Theatre Act, and then of course we couldn't hold it because of the numbers restriction. But we'll get back to that.
Yes,
it really is an important discussion for Fremantle, and in many ways you fear it's out of the local hands. But let's wait and see. In terms of your own ward, is there any burning issue as we sit here today? Anything that you'd like to see happen anywhere within the ward?
I think one thing I'd really like to see some progress on is getting power underground in both Hilton and Sampson. Now, in Hilton, that's looking reasonably likely. The city office are negotiating with Western Power around that. You know, it's very expensive putting power underground. Especially when some of the subsidies, the state subsidies that used to exist, got taken away. Mm. Basically, Western Power charges you $10,000 per residence to put power underground. So unless they're prepared to contribute to the cost, it's just too much of a burden to put onto each resident. You know, even if you do a poll of the street, the majority say yes. If there's someone who can't afford it, yes, and even if that's averaged out over a number of rate bills, a special levy to pay for it, it's just too much. So it's looking quite positive that that will happen in Hilton. And that's really important. I mean, one is, as someone who's familiar with Hilton, you'll know that, yes, Hilton has trees down every side of the street and it looks glorious, but there's you always feel sorry for the poor stunted trees on the power line side of the street. Yes. You never reach their full potential. And allowing that, you know, avenue of trees down both sides of the street to really reach its own is especially important because of subdivision. So Hilton might be the garden suburb, but it is losing trees in backyards. You know, it inevitably comes with, even if done sensitively, which it isn't always done, subdivision in Hilton is causing the loss of mature trees in backyards. And so it becomes all the more important to compensate for that by having street trees. You know,
good point. Yeah.
And I think even though we're not seeing that sort of subdivision happen in Sampson, and we are putting trees down one side of the street in Sampson.
Yes.
If we could get the power underground in Sampson, we could then have trees down both sides of the street. And just the, you know, the look and the feel, the walkability, and as soon as people start becoming pedestrians again, just the social interactions that take place, people get to know their neighbours. You know, that's why cycling's so important as well. It's actually just a means to an end.
Yes.
And the end is actually that social interaction. You know, people caring for their neighbour, getting to know them, know people, that sort of stuff. It's just so important. And it would just, you know, open the door to that possibility. I think they are things that would really, really, really... really help those suburbs. That's right. I mean, the other thing we're going to have to find the ways to fund in the future that because of densification is better park facilities in the suburbs as well. You know, this is a bit like the discussion or the point I made around sort of public transport. You know, if you're going to have densification, then you need the public spaces.
You need the public spaces
to compensate for it. Yeah.
Sam, it's been a wide-ranging discussion, and I've really appreciated on the very last topic. Shipping News republished a post the other day which we called Living on the Edges, which is all about that community sense and how communities get together and how COVID has sort of in many ways pointed this up again, so that you get to know your neighbours, you do things on your street, the streets have eyes, the houses have eyes on the street, and all of that sort of thing. But your focusing on them today has been really interesting. Thanks for meeting with the Shipping News. And
thanks very much for the opportunity once again, and I've enjoyed it.
Thanks.